excuse of a sister.
Stop.
You are one sad excuse of a human being.
Stop it. Just stop, Mickey.
As far as I'm concerned, I have no sister. I wish you died in the womb.
Whoa. I think I just figured something out, Beavis.
What?
This sucks.
It really sucks.
This sucks more than anything that has ever sucked before.
The Salamonster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the street.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
I'm fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Welcome to a special Labor Day weekend edition of the Salamonster Sounds Off podcast here for Sunday, August 31st, 2014. I am the Salamonster. Can you believe summer is just about over? You know how depressing that is? Summer is over. It's done. I feel like it never even started. I think we've had all of like 4 days that hit 90 degrees here in New York. And now September is upon us, and they're already predicting another polar vortex here in New York. So, can't wait for that. Can't wait to freeze my nuts off waiting for the bus to go to work. That's always fun. We have some PayPal shout-outs to get to here for people who have made a donation to the podcast, which you can do on thesolomonster.com. That is where the PayPal donation box is always located. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname. As these folks have done, Javon Main Event Mallet, The Reflection of Perfection, Abraham Lara, Tori All I Do Is Win Johansson, Illustrious Ilka Mantir, Kingpin Jason Kaiser, Awesome Andrew Cunningham, Eugene Crazy Eyes Morgan, Daniel Bulldozer Bustamante Yao, that's a long name, Casey Hellfire Harris, and Burris Zero Johnson. And also, we have two more very special shout-outs here. Omnipotent Omar Primitivo and Angelic Elizabeth Aguilar from the Bronx and Queens, respectively. The two lovebirds are getting hitched next Saturday, September 6th. I want to wish them both the best. Here's to a drama-free ceremony, unlike most wrestling weddings. We all know how those usually work out. I'm sure that you will have the DJ playing episodes of The Sound Off on a loop during the wedding party, because music is so overrated. But in all seriousness, nothing but health and happiness from all of us to you both. So thank you to everybody who made a donation. Again, please, you can do so on thesolomonster.com if you would like. And you can also sign up for a free Audible trial using our custom URL, audibletrial.com/solomonster. August was our biggest month. It's not over yet. It's still a few hours left. We could still inch that record up even more. But we've had a record number of signups this month. You guys have been recommending friends, family. A lot of you guys seem to like the service, which is really cool. It's an audiobook service for those of you who don't know. You get one free audiobook that you get to keep no matter what as part of your 30-day trial, whether you stick with the service or not. All you got to do is use audibletrial.com/solomonster. Use that URL. If from there you sign up, it helps the podcast out, so please consider signing up there. We start with some not-so-good news, an update on the condition of Jake the Snake Roberts. Several days ago, there was some breaking news. Wasn't confirmed anywhere at first, so people didn't know what to make of it. Is it true? Is it not true? Apparently, it is true, unfortunately. Jake was on his way to Las Vegas to work, I think, a show, or at least appear at a show for Sim Bodie, the former Kizarni, who had a short-lived run in WWE. The two of them have become good friends. I think it was Kizarni's birthday. Jake just really wanted to be there, but apparently he had not been feeling well for about a week. They thought maybe he had the flu. Obviously didn't take care of himself. He was still running around and said, I'm going to make this shot no matter what. And what happened is, I guess, there was some stories that went back and forth that said he fell unconscious on a flight. That's not exactly what happened. What happened was, he realized on the flight to Vegas that something's not right here. I don't feel well. He let the flight staff know. When the flight landed, there was an ambulance already there waiting for him to take him to the hospital. He has since been transferred to another hospital in Vegas. What he's battling right now, which is very serious, especially the older you are, and if you've had other health issues, as Jake has, he is battling double pneumonia. Pneumonia in both of his lungs. There's been a massive fluid buildup there. He can't breathe. He's in a lot of pain and discomfort. And the last update, as of early this morning, straight from Diamond Dallas Page, who obviously is very close to Jake, is that they have sedated him and put him on a ventilator to help with his breathing because of all the fluid that's built up in his lungs. And they're trying to pump it out, but that fluid is still building up, and that's not good. That's not good at all. He did not collapse on the flight to Vegas. Again, he told the crew in advance, "I don't feel well." Thankfully, they had an ambulance there to pick him up. When he got to the hospital, apparently he was unconscious for a long time. And since then, he's been in and out of consciousness. They were giving updates that kind of seemed optimistic a couple of days ago, where he was alert. He was communicating with his girlfriend, his family, the people around him. He was very, you know, frustrated having to be there. But now they've had to sedate him and put him on a ventilator. And I don't know what to make of all this. The other thing about this, apparently, and nobody's really talked too much about it, but they discovered a mass on his brain. I guess whatever tests, MRIs, whatever they did, they found a mass on his brain that may or may not be related to what's going on here. It may completely be unrelated. They seem to think that it's from all the years of taking bumps in the ring. I sure hope that's all it is. If that's true, you know, you hear mass on the brain and immediately you think far worse. So we'll see if he can pull through this. I hope he does. I mean, he's been through too much shit in his life to have pneumonia be what finally does him in. I mean, how anticlimactic would that be? After the life that Jake the Snake Roberts has lived and all the shit and everything else and the addictions and seemingly kicking the addictions and turning his life around and making amends with his kids. Now he's got grandkids. We saw them at the Hall of Fame. Going into the Hall of Fame, which I know was a goal of his for many years. He just had cancer. He just beat cancer. Only, you know, a few weeks ago, he announced that he was officially in remission from cancer. And now this. So hopefully he's able to beat it, but he's in rough shape right now. And they said that if you want to send well wishes, you can tweet him at Jake Snake. I think it's at Jake Snake DDT, I think is his Twitter handle. So you could send well wishes there. But we're all pulling for Jake the Snake. Also, I want to mention here before we get to Raw from last Monday, and what a show that was, but I do want to mention this. I had a chance to listen to Jim Ross's podcast earlier this week. He had Tony Schiavone, former WCW and WWE announcer, on his podcast, and Tony does not do very many podcasts. I don't think he does any of them, hardly. He's made a few appearances at some of these wrestling conventions, but for the most part, he's been out of wrestling since WCW went under. He made one appearance for TNA in the early years, maybe the first year of TNA. So you're looking at 2002, probably, which was right after WCW went under. And ever since then, he has been completely out of wrestling. You know, baseball is his passion. He's been doing, I think he's been the play-by-play announcer for the AAA minor league team for the Atlanta Braves. And that's what he's been doing. And he seems very content and very happy. He talked about that on the podcast. But I thought that this was JR's best interview yet. I haven't heard every interview he's done. I've listened to a few of them. But I just think one of the knocks on JR, and I would have to agree, was, you know, the constant interruptions when he would be interviewing somebody and he would interject far too much and then he would wax eloquently and go off on a tangent. Meanwhile, the guest is kind of just sitting there on the line. He interviewed Sting last month, and I listened to it, and it was a good interview, but it was also very frustrating to listen to. It just was driving me nuts with some of his interviews. But this was a really fun discussion. There was none of that. There were few, if any, interruptions. It was just a nice conversation between two old friends back and forth, talking about their days in Crockett, the rotating band of merry men that they brought in to run WCW, Jim Herd, Kip Fry, Bill Watts, Eric Bischoff. They talk about Tony's year with the WWF in the late 80s. I think it went from 89 into 1990, and that's when he left. It was just one year that he had there, but they talked about that one year, why he feels it was the best year of his career, which surprised me when I heard him say that, why he left, and what Vince McMahon's assistant told him when he immediately tried to get his job back, which obviously didn't happen. And they get into the Bobby Heenan stuff, which is what I was most interested in hearing about, because for years, and in his book, too, that came out a long time ago, Bobby Heenan is no fan of Tony Schiavone. He does not have nice things to say about Schiavone at all from their time together in WCW. Bobby would used to do interviews for radio shows, podcasts, and stuff like that. And every time the subject of Tony Schiavone would come up, he would pause and, I guess, you know, walk into his bathroom and he would flush the toilet, which tells you what he thinks of Tony Schiavone, or at least back then, what he thought of Tony Schiavone. And Tony talks about that. He talks about, you know, why Heenan would feel that way and what he thinks of Bobby Heenan. And it's very, very fascinating to hear them talk about that. So I think it's well worth going out of your way to check out. I don't know how many of you guys listen to JR's podcast. Again, I don't have a chance to listen to it all the time. But this is one interview that is worth checking out. And again, a rare conversation with a guy who just doesn't really do many of these interviews. And also gets, you know, he gets the brunt of a lot of jokes from his time in WCW and every night being the greatest night in the history of our sport. But you know what I've come to realize recently? As awful as the commentary is in WWE, as awful and horrendous as it can be on Monday nights to listen to those three guys, whether it's their fault or just what they're told to do or whatever, more often than not, the commentary is so bad you just want to mute the sound and just not have any sound at all. That's how bad it is. And I think now I'm finally starting to really appreciate the greatness of Tony Schiavone. Tony Schiavone was not a bad wrestling announcer. He became something of a parody of himself when he would say stuff like that. And he even admits in the interview with JR, at the end there, the last year or two at WCW, he just didn't care. I mean, he had mentally checked out. He was burnt out. He did not give a shit. But I think he's underrated as an announcer, and I think all these years later in 2014, as bad as the announcing can be, it makes me appreciate a guy like him even more and long for the days when we had guys like Tony Schiavone on commentary doing play-by-play who actually could make a match or could make a show feel special. And I feel like now it's not really a priority with the announcers. It's more, they're more interested in making each other laugh, even when the audience doesn't find what they're talking about to be funny at all. And you have all the plugs for Twitter and hashtags and the app and the network, which I guess they have to do. But it's just not the same anymore. It makes me want to put cotton balls in my ears. And it makes me appreciate a guy like Schiavone even more. So check out the interview. I think you'll like it. Which brings me to Monday Night Raw. This past week was live from Anaheim, California, out on the West Coast. Not one distraction roll-up on this show. The day after I issued my challenge to WWE to donate $250 to charity each time they do that stupid finish. Bunch of cheap asses. So that's about the only good thing I could say about this show. Not the only good thing, but that's one of the few good things I can say about this show. So just be prepared for that, because I got a lot to get off my chest as far as this show goes from last Monday night. Okay? Raw was awful. It was an awful show last Monday. Just a waste of 3 hours. Forget 2 hours. You know, sometimes we talk about, well, I wish Raw would go back to 2 hours. Forget that. Fuck that. Had this show been an hour long, okay, 60 minutes, maybe 90 minutes, it probably would have been fine, maybe even good. Have John Cena just cut a quick, serious promo. You air the Brock Lesnar video package that they had on this show. Give the Usos and Goldust and Stardust some time for their match. You follow that by the heel turn they did, which I actually think has promise and has some potential. Give Paige and Natalya more than 2 minutes, and then you tack on a main event, and there's your show. You know what? That would have been fine. We didn't get that, though. And by the end of the 3 hours, I was bored to death. I was bored to death. I was angry that I sat there and I wasted my time. It was just a bad show. They can't all be winners. Okay, I understand that. They can't all be home runs. Sometimes you got to take a single or a double. This was not a single. This was not a double. This was not a triple. This was not a home run. This was not, oh shit, he walked the batter and the batter comes home and wins the game. This was a whiff. A swing and a miss on Monday night. And it's funny how some people get so defensive. When I said that Raw was bad and that it sucked, on Facebook I posted a status and people got, not everybody, but some people got up in arms about that. I had one kumquat who called me a fake fan for saying that Raw sucked. I can't even remember the last time I felt strongly enough to post a status on Facebook that just simply said Raw sucked when the show was over. And the reason is, I never do that. But apparently that makes me a fake fan. I'm not even sure what that means. You know, if only your mother had a fake pregnancy, I wouldn't have to waste my time trying to figure out what the hell that means. I mean, I swear, the WWE diehards, because every company has them. The WWE diehards, though, they're even worse than the TNA ones. The TNA ones, at least, I feel pity on. I almost have this weird respect for them. That they would, you know, the ship is going down, it's sinking, it's like the Titanic, right? You got the orchestra, the band playing on the deck, people are jumping off like rats off a sinking ship, wrestlers are leaving, and production people are leaving, PR people are leaving, and there are people who are just, they're not going anywhere. Nope, they're going to go down with the ship. I almost have a weird respect for people like that. Show opened with a Hall of Fame forum in the ring with Hulk Hogan, Shawn Michaels, Ric Flair, moderated by Michael Cole. They all talked about the John Cena versus Brock Lesnar match, the rematch, and Night of Champions. Shawn said that John Cena doesn't stand a chance, and he should probably just retire. That's what he said. He can't beat Brock, so he may as well just call it a day. Ric Flair said he didn't think Cena stood a chance either, although he liked him. Hulk Hogan had to be the voice of reason and point out that even though he got his ass kicked at Extreme Rules 2 years ago, Cena still found a way to win. He'll come back stronger than ever, brother. Of course, Hulk is going to cheer for John Cena to come back and win because he wants a match with him at next year's WrestleMania. That Hulkster, always looking out for number one. Then out came the man himself, John Cena, showing no ill effects of the beating that Brock Lesnar laid down upon him at SummerSlam. No tape, no bruises, no selling of the neck, which he got dropped on 16 different times in that match. He was sick of everybody telling him what he should do. He also called this rematch the biggest rematch of his career. Every match is the biggest match of this guy's career, until it's over, and then it's not. You know, after that first match he had with The Rock, okay, WrestleMania 28, he lost. He kept telling us, leading up to that match, that if he lost at WrestleMania, he would lose everything. I mean, this guy sold it like, if I lose to The Rock, if I come out of Miami a loser, my life is over. My career is over. Everything I've accomplished means nothing. It's wiped away. Like, that's how he sold it. And then a month later, there he is on Raw, cracking jokes about it backstage with Vince McMahon. I think Vince made a comment like, hey, didn't you say that if you know, you didn't win at WrestleMania, you would lose everything. Like, I don't remember the exact dialogue. It was something like that. And I just remember watching that and going, wow. Wow. And these guys expect to sell us on big matches going forward. And this is how they blow this thing off. This is how they treat it. I still haven't forgotten. That was 2 years ago. And I still haven't forgotten that. Over 2 years. And ever since then, I can't take any of these claims seriously. So at Night of Champions, Cena vowed not to beat Brock Lesnar, but to beat Brock Lesnar's ass. And I could say the only thing I liked about this was that at least John Cena was not there to crack jokes. This was not jokey John Cena. This was not narrator John Cena. He came out. He had a stern look on his face. He was serious. He was to the point. He didn't overstay his welcome. And he left. The problem is, the segment didn't work. It did nothing to get me excited for a rematch between these two guys at Night of Champions. And the legend stuff, you know, I gotta say this. The legend stuff is so forced. John Cena being back on TV so soon and showing no ill effects from the beating he took at SummerSlam, from the worst beating of his career, was ridiculous. I mean, I'm just watching this, thinking to myself, the art of wrestling is dead. Dead! Batista was on Chris Jericho's podcast this week. Another good interview, by the way. Two-parter. Worth checking out. Batista is a very likable guy, very down-to-earth, very honest. He's very honest with his feelings. He doesn't sugarcoat it. If he's not happy with the company or the direction or whatever, he just lays it all out there. I respect that about Big Dave. He was on with Chris Jericho talking about WWE not having Daniel Bryan sell the beating he took at WrestleMania after the main event when it was over. You know, Bryan wrestled a competitive match with Triple H to open the show, 20 minutes, 25 minutes, whatever it was, and he won. And then, not only that, a long match against a guy like Triple H. Triple H beat his ass after the match, injured his arm using the steel post. Bryan comes back out at the end of the show, wrestles essentially what's a handicap match, let's be honest, against Batista and Randy Orton, two other big stars in the company. Somehow he wins, and Batista says, you know, the match is over, and the guy's not selling anything. He's not selling how hurt he is. He's not selling his arm. You know, and I can almost excuse that because that was Bryan's time to hold up the belts. You got two heavy belts to hold up. I mean, how much can he really sell the arm? But that was his moment to celebrate and do the yes thing, and the fireworks go off, and like, I'm okay with that, but I think he has a point. Like, even the next night, he comes out, he's jumping up in the air, doing the yes chant, and just looks like, hey, I'm okay, I'm fine. Even though I got my ass beat by three of the best stars in the company, you know, and I was thoroughly outnumbered, even though I won, he looked fine. And apparently this bothered Batista a great deal. It drove him nuts. He said that kind of thing drives him nuts. What must this guy be thinking of John Cena after SummerSlam? I would love for somebody to ask Dave Batista what he thought of that. So in the fact that this segment failed and the Brock Lesnar video package succeeded, I thought that that did a great job, far more than this did, of getting me hyped for a rematch. That tells me that it would have been a better idea to keep John Cena off television, which they should have done anyway. They kept him off for a week, keep him off for longer than a week, and instead film a package with him like you did with Brock. Show him being, you know, icing himself down, licking his wounds from SummerSlam, back in the gym, training, lifting weights, doing snatch, whatever that stuff is he talks about on his Twitter, preparing for the fight of his life. He's got one last shot to make it right. That's the story. He was humbled at SummerSlam. He ate humble pie, and it didn't taste good. It won't happen again. You know, that sort of thing. He doesn't even have to, you know, be live in the building for that. You could just trot him out for the dark match when the show is over so the live crowd doesn't feel cheated that they didn't get Brock Lesnar or John Cena, but he doesn't have to actually be on television. This segment did not accomplish any of those things. It felt forced. It felt hokey. It didn't. There was nothing said to make me feel like, oh, wow, wait, I can't wait to see this match now. Things are going to be different. You know, we heard nothing from Cena that we haven't heard a million times before. It was a good promo. I was happy he was serious, but we've heard the same John Cena promo a million frickin' times before. And I am sick to death of them trotting the legends out there to endorse John Cena. I mean, I guess Shawn Michaels didn't, but Flair said, you know, hey, I love John Cena. I just don't think he's going to win, but he's a great guy. And Hulk Hogan's out there filleting him. How many times over the years have we seen them trot those guys out there to endorse John Cena as a way to get the crowd behind him? They tried it with Mick Foley. It didn't work. They tried it with Bret Hart. It didn't work. They tried it with The Rock. For God's sake, the whole point of that program, 3 years, was that in the end, Rock puts over John Cena, passes the torch, and Cena finally, hopefully, gains the respect and the support from the fans. That didn't work either. He got booed at the end of that WrestleMania. I was there. You know, they did the whole thing where Rock does the walk up the ramp. He does the little salute to John Cena on the stage. He raises Cena's hand. He says, hey, he's the man now. And the place booed. That's not what they wanted to see. So yeah, they made a shitload of money off it, but in the end, it didn't work. I can't think of another top guy in the history of this company that they've done that with, sending top guys from the past out there to put their stamp of approval on the dude, like, come on, everybody, let's like John Cena. He's a swell guy. I'm sure he is. I'm sure he is, but it's just nauseating. And the most important thing is, it's not working. So I wish they would stop. They're finally bringing WCW Monday Nitro to the WWE Network starting this week. 100 hours worth, we were told. So that should cover the first year, maybe year and a half of Nitro. I know Nitro, when they started out, it was an hour long. And I think they went to 2 hours a few months after that. Maybe, I mean, I don't know how many months, but very shortly after that, it went to a two-hour format. So I think 100 hours, yeah, I mean, you're probably looking at a year, year and a half max. So that sounds about right. I do have to admit, as bad as this show was last Monday, it's still better than Nitro was in its final year. That's how atrocious WCW was there by the end. For every three count or Young Dragons match. Wow, that's a blast from the past, Young Dragons. You know, there were five awful segments on that show. They had a lot of really, like, young, talented guys, high flyers and stuff, who finally, at the end, because a lot of the big stars were gone, and because they had nothing left to lose, they started featuring them a little bit more, you know, the cruiserweight stuff. But, you know, for every one or two great matches, you had five atrocious segments. Anyway. They also aired a commercial for an old Jeff Hardy documentary airing on the network, Beyond the Ring. And they were sure to include comments in this commercial about Jeff Hardy violating their wellness policy. I thought that was hilarious. It's not like they had to put that in the commercial, but they did. Swagger and Rusev had another match, which actually had quite a bit of heat from the crowd. Probably had the second most heat from the crowd of anything on the entire show besides the main event. Ref stoppage after the abuse to Swagger's ribs. He just couldn't take it anymore. The referee said, that's it, enough. He called the match off. Still no Zeb. He's still gone. Zeb Coulter apparently sells his injuries better than John Cena does. Later on in the trainer's room, Bo Dallas told Jack Swagger to Bo leave. So this is leading to a match at some point. To the people who think that this is proof they haven't given up on Bo Dallas, I had two people say to me, oh, see, they didn't give up on him. I hope that's the case, but he's feuding with Jack Swagger, people. Okay, that's hardly evidence that they have not given up on the guy. Given up doesn't mean they get fired necessarily or they just disappear entirely from television, like Emma, who I guess was on SmackDown. She finally reappeared Friday night, Emma did. But before that, I couldn't tell you the last time she was on TV. What it means is that whatever plans they may have had for the guy have been abandoned, or they have no plans for anything meaningful at all for the guy. That has not changed. I have seen no evidence that has changed. And I really do. I think they missed their shot with that battle royal at Battleground to keep the undefeated streak going and have Dallas win the Intercontinental title. I really do. I mean, it almost would have reminded me of the old Honky Tonk Man title reign, where the guy, he's kind of looked at as a joke, but he's hated. He gets the people just to hate him. Somehow he keeps winning, and you're just waiting for that person to come along and just smack that smug smile off his face and take the championship from him. I could have seen Bo Dallas go on for a pretty lengthy run with the Intercontinental title, and it would have been perfect if Bad News Barrett comes back, because the last time we saw him, he had to give up the Intercontinental title. Bad News Barrett comes back. He's targeting December. By then, Dallas would have been champion for several months, and Barrett comes back, and he's got a ready-made feud as a babyface, and people want to see him bullhammer that smile right off Bo's face. So, you know, that's one direction they could have gone in they didn't want to. And so now Bo Dallas is feuding with Jack Swagger, who can't win a match to save his life. Cesaro pinned Job Van Dam with the neutralizer to become the number one contender to Sheamus' U.S. title at Night of Champions. RVD is now done. He is finished with the company for now. He takes his breaks, I think, every 90 days or so he's gone. Sheamus was at ringside doing commentary. It's one thing for Van Dam to lose, but he lost out of nowhere. It was like, wow. You know, not that I'm complaining. It made Cesaro look strong for the first time in months. And again, it was Van Dam's final Raw match for however many months before he comes back again. So that was fine. But, you know, if you're going to go out, that's the way to do it. Make the other guy look strong. Afterwards, Cesaro stole the U.S. title from Sheamus. Then he threw it in his face. I brought up another point on Twitter during the show. I wonder if the same people who complain about how Roman Reigns uses the same moves over and over again and how he doesn't have enough moves, it's the same old shit, all of that kind of stuff. I wonder how those people feel about RVD. You know, if they're consistent, they would feel the same way about a guy like Rob Van Dam, would they not? He uses the same spots every match, the same kicks, you know, Rolling Thunder, five-star frog splash, split-legged moonsault, right? Same shit with him. And I said that, and one person was like, yeah, well, you know, he can fly further than Roman Reigns can. He can fly further. Wow, okay. Someone else was like, RVD has 20 years of experience. We know what he's capable of. You can't compare the two. Of course you can't compare Roman Reigns to a guy with 20 years experience. He's got 3 years, maybe four, Roman Reigns does. But yeah, I mean, come on, RVD's matches all look the same. You can't, it's a double standard. RVD used to be great. Absolutely. When RVD first came over to WWE, when they were doing the invasion, he was the one guy who, when his matches were on, I was glued to the TV. You know, I knew him at ECW. I didn't watch ECW a whole lot back then. It's not like I didn't know who Van Damme was. But when he came over and those matches with Jeff Hardy and some of the other guys, I was like, wow, this guy is unbelievable. He's innovative. He's athletic. He moves around like nobody else can on the roster. He's got these really cool moves. People were into him. It was must-see TV whenever he was on screen. But that was also 12 years ago, 13 years ago. His matches are no different in that same respect than a Roman Reigns. If you're going to complain about that with Roman Reigns, then you've got to be consistent with it and say the same thing about a Rob Van Dam. And I could probably rattle off more names than just RVD. I'm not trying to like pin this all on RVD like he's a bad wrestler. But I'm just saying, I think that excuse when it comes to Roman Reigns is complete bullshit. Everybody has their go-to moves. Everybody has their spots. So I think if you don't like the guy, that's fine, but you're going to have to do better than that if you're going to bash him. You need a better reason than that. Paige pinned Natalya with the Paige Turner. Diva stopwatch clocked this at 2 minutes 53 seconds. Natalya has supposedly been pitching to work a real match with Paige. Ain't going to happen on this show, so she's better off pitching it for like main event or a house show. It's just not going to happen on Raw. They're never going to give them that time that she would probably want for a match like that. I guess 3 hours is clearly not enough time. Now, this was completely ridiculous. Natalya comes out, and Michael Cole says if Natalya can beat Paige tonight, she might just earn herself a shot at the Divas title. She's beaten the champion twice. She needs to beat her a third time now to get a title shot. Goldust and Stardust pinned the Usos the week before, and the very next week they get a championship match. I mean, talk about a double standard. So, to answer my own question from last week, no. There will be no four-way at Night of Champions with Natalya and Eva Marie and AJ and Paige for the title. You know, no Eva Marie, no problem. But she also beat the champion twice. No title shot. I mean, I swear, they make this shit up as they go along. So Paige wins. AJ comes skipping down to the ring. At least we didn't get another distraction. Paige finally smartened up on that. Natalya, being the sour sport that she is, she clotheslines Paige from behind, knocks her down. AJ gets in the ring. She helps Paige to her feet, calls her my little English muffin. Then she hugs her, and she kisses Paige's hand before skipping away. If this was 10 years ago, we'd have people chanting for HLA and two fat Samoans would beat the crap out of these two women. I can't say I missed that. That's one change, I think, for the better. By the way, they did Paige vs. Emma on SmackDown. I mentioned before Emma was on the show on Friday night. They did Paige vs. Emma, and if you blinked, you missed it. And you wonder why I don't bother watching that show. Moving to Thursdays is not going to change that. Seth Rollins and Corporate Kane came out for the eulogy of Dean Ambrose. I didn't even know he was dead. You would think Renee Young would want to attend, but she didn't show up. Whole time I'm sitting there waiting for Ambrose to just run over Seth's brand new Lincoln Continental with a monster truck. You know, if they insist on rehashing old Rock and Austin angles with these guys, at least do it right. You know what I mean? It's funny, too, because the feud between these two is probably the closest thing we have right now to anything like Rock versus Austin back when they were feuding. They showed a replay of Rollins killing Ambrose by squashing his skull on the styrofoam cinder blocks. Rollins said that we would never see Ambrose again. Finally, I have destroyed the Shield, he said. Well, not so fast. Out comes Roman Reigns, who has a loose end that he has never tied up with Seth Rollins. It is kind of odd the way that Dean Ambrose just went all ape shit on Seth Rollins and they're still feuding. But Roman Reigns, he's cool as cucumber, man. He doesn't seem to have any issues with Seth Rollins. He just lets Rollins do his own thing, and Reigns is like, hey, I want to be champion. Fuck you guys. You know? Roman Reigns was the real mercenary in that group. But he comes out here, made short work of Kane, went after Rollins. They brawled for a bit. Reigns went for a spear. Kane pulled him out to safety. This all led to a handicap match later in the show. Usos and Goldust and Stardust for the tag team titles. Too short to be anything really special. Believe me, these two teams are capable of a lot more than what we saw here. These guys are going to have a great match at the pay-per-view. It just puzzles me, though, that even if the plan is to do the rematch on pay-per-view, you can't afford to give these four guys a decent amount of time to have a good match. You know, it's like you have 3 hours, and everything still feels rushed. You would think that once they expanded to 3 hours, they could let things breathe more, we can get longer matches. For a while, we did. I mean, the one thing I have to say, if I had to say what the most positive thing was about Raw moving to 3 hours, it was the fact that we got all of those awesome Shield six-man tag team matches. We're going to look back on that as probably the best part of Raw moving to 3 hours, or at least I will. Because if the show was only 2 hours, I doubt that week after week we would have gotten matches that were allowed to go that long and be as good as they were. But they gave those guys week after week 15, 16, 18, sometimes 20 minutes or more if they were in the main event. And they are what sustained that show throughout most of this year and even part of last year. That's how great those guys were together. Now that the Shield is broken up, I don't really have anything I can point to as a positive about these shows. Everything is still rushed. The Divas get 2 minutes. Matches like this don't get any time, even if they're building to something. You can afford to give these guys a few more minutes than what you give them. Don't just assume that, you know, we're just going to sit there for 3 hours and it's okay to do shit like that because we're going to give them 15 minutes at the pay-per-view. Well, what about the 3 fucking hours I just sat here investing in your show? What do I get for that? You know, why do I have to feel punished for that? And they've been doing this a lot lately. And I don't like it. I don't like that trend. So they could have given this more time. They didn't. Jay tweaked his knee on a dive to the outside. Couldn't make it back in the ring before the 10 count, so the Dustbusters win by count out. You know, if they would just institute a 20 count rule like ROH or New Japan, we could avoid all of these pesky little count outs. I actually don't think that would be a bad idea, to be honest with you. It probably would make it more dramatic, too, because then the referee wouldn't have to obnoxiously count slow or obnoxiously count fast like they sometimes have to. You know, sometimes they'll speed the count up in the middle of it because, we know what the finish is and we got to speed things up or slow it down. It's like, at least be consistent. If you got a 20 count, then the referee, there's no reason to speed it up or slow it down. If you can't get your ass back in the ring by the count of 20, then you deserve to lose. Goldust was not pleased at this turn of events. He accused Jay of faking an injury and then challenged them to an immediate rematch. And the Usos didn't seem very interested in that. And so he and Stardust attacked the Usos and they turned heel. Crowd started booing, so they took it the same way. They knew this was a heel turn. This was one of only two things on the show that I liked. I think there's potential in a heel Goldust and Stardust. Hopefully we get a straight-up 2-on-2 match at Night of Champions, not some convoluted four-way with teams that don't deserve to be in there and are just going to take up space. I'm looking at you, Big Show and Mark Henry. And you know what? I'll throw the Wyatts in there too because they lose every frickin' match they're in. They've already lost to the Usos a whole bunch of times. They don't deserve a shot either. So hopefully it's just a straight 2-on-2 match. Then we have the Brock Lesnar-Paul Heyman video package. You may have been able to guess this was the other favorite thing of mine on this show. Brock feels disrespected that John Cena would even dare exercise his rematch clause after the beating he suffered at SummerSlam. I don't know why he would feel disrespected by that. Of course, hey, he comes out there, he looks fine. He's got no reason not to exercise his rematch clause. He's all hunky-dory. He looks 100% ready to go. Brock was his usual great self during these videos. You know, you script stuff for him and stick a live mic in his hands, and you never know what you're going to get. Probably not going to be good. Sit him down, though, in front of a camera without a script and just let him loose, and he's gold every time. Heyman is just the icing on the cake with these things. Brock said Cena's never give up bullshit kicked in at the... It's just great. Oh, I love it. His never give up bullshit kicked in at SummerSlam, but didn't do him any good. He F5'd him in the first 30 seconds of the match to give Cena a way out before it was too late. But he didn't take it. And at Night of Champions, he's going to make sure that it's game over for John Cena. Almost brings a tear to my eye, he said at the end of the segment. Best thing on the entire show. And you know what? When the best thing on the entire show is a 5-minute long segment that was taped in a studio a week before, I just can't call this a good show. Dolph Ziggler and The Miz never happened. Instead, Miz brought out Damian Mizdow as his stunt double. Out came Sandow, dressed like The Miz. Dolph beat him quickly. On commentary, Miz said that he was firing Sandow as his stunt double. So, of course, on SmackDown, he was right back on TV working as Miz's stunt double. And then came the Bella Twins. Jerry Lawler is in the ring for what he had hoped would be a family reconciliation between Nikki and Brie. Things did not go as planned. Brie apologized again, even though it was her sister who cost her the match with Stephanie at SummerSlam and slapped her across the face the next night on Raw. But it was Brie who apologized. You know, that's like Dick Cheney shooting his friend in the face on a hunting trip, and the friend ends up apologizing to Dick Cheney. "I'm sorry I was in the way when you shot me." That actually happened, by the way. Brie said that when their mother was pregnant, she saw the ultrasounds of her and Nikki holding hands in the womb. Nikki pretended like she might actually make up with her sister. Maybe they were finally going to patch things up here. But then she tore into her and her troll face husband. Nikki said that Brie abandoned her when she quit at Payback, and as a result, she had to endure abuse from the authority week after week, handicap match after handicap match. Which is true. I like the fact that she would at least bring that up, because that at least makes sense. If there's any reason to think that Nikki would have ill feelings towards her sister, that I can believe. That her sister opted to quit. She wasn't fired. She chose to leave and didn't take into account the negative consequences that would have on her twin sister. That I can believe. She said Brie was selfish, only thought about herself. This is when Brie began to act. And that is never a good thing. When Brie Bella begins to act, that is not good. Nikki is better than her sister. I'll give her that. But, you know, that's like saying, I'd rather be stabbed in the gut than shot in the head. You know, neither outcome is desirable. Lawler tried to interject. Nikki told him to stay out of it, old man. I'm sure that's not the first time Lawler has had a woman say that to him. She told Brie, "I no longer have a sister." And then came the line of the night when Nikki told her sister, "I wish you died in the womb." I wish you died in the womb. This reminded me of when Vince McMahon told Shane, "I will never, ever forgive your mother for giving birth to you." When there is a family feud in WWE, give him credit. At least they go all the way with it. They go full bore, over the top. You know, there is no in between. So she says the line, and at that moment, you could hear a pin drop in the arena. There was no, "Oh my God" reaction. There was no, "Ooh, what did she just say?" Like, none of that. It was just silent. And Brie cried. At least I think she did. Somebody had a great comment on Twitter. I wish I knew who it was. They had a shot of Brie crying, sobbing uncontrollably, down on her knees, and Lawler's trying to console her. And they had a close-up shot of Brie's face. And somebody just said, her face, she looks like a melting candle. That's the best description all night that I saw for what Brie Bella looked like here. She looked like a melting candle. That's what her face looked like here. And all the makeup and everything. So she's crying, and Nikki grabs her by the hair and pushes her over in the chair that she's sitting in. And then Nikki starts beating the hell out of her sister. And Lawler is, you know, the officials are trying to get her off. She's doing the ground and pound on Brie. And Brie just looked like a complete fool here. All this woman ever does is cry. That's it. She acts like an abuse victim. She was the one who was abused by her sister. She was the one who got beaten up by her own sister. And instead, she's apologizing to her. And she cries all the time. She's like an abuse victim. And we're supposed to get behind her as some big baby face. It doesn't work that way. You know? Brie has stolen Natalya's gimmick. If I'm Natalya, I'm pissed. But she's just the worst babyface on the planet. She's now less over than she was when her feud with Stephanie began. Nikki was better than Brie, but like I said before, that's not saying much. The acting here. Oh my God, the acting. Just cringeworthy. And I said last week, brother versus brother, sister versus sister, it rarely works. Brett and Owen, it worked. it worked. And you knew with Bret knowing that you were at least going to get great dramatic matches out of it, which they had. There's no great match to look forward to here. There is no outcome. There's no payoff. I have no interest in seeing the payoff to this. What is the payoff? Please tell me what the payoff is to this feud. What was the payoff to the Funkadactyls feud with Cameron and Naomi? And I know Naomi now is hurt. I think her eye is still bothering her. She may need surgery again. It's terrible. But for months, they haven't been doing anything on TV. You know, they had a match on the pre-show for, I think, Payback or whatever pay-per-view it was. Maybe Battleground. And just nothing ever since. There was no resolution to it. I mean, maybe they did it on Superstars and I missed it. You know what? It's entirely possible, too, because from what people tell me, whenever they show footage of matches on Total Divas, they see the Superstars banner. Apparently, they take footage from Superstars and act as though, for people who don't know any better, who may not be wrestling fans, they just see them wrestling and probably assume, hey, they're on Raw. Most of the time, that's not the case. So maybe they did wrap up their feud in some Superstars match that 15 people saw, but if not, there's another example for you. No payoff. They just kind of dropped it. I wish they would do that with this feud. I hope they do. This was just bad. Just bad, 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 bad. I wish this segment died in the womb. Roman Reigns beat Kane and Seth Rollins by DQ. Yet another short match. Rollins used the briefcase. He got DQ'd. They tried to murder Roman with cinder blocks just like they did Ambrose the week before. Unlike Ambrose, though, Reigns fought his way free, laid out Kane, then he grabbed one of the cinder blocks, tried to throw it at Rollins, but he ducked. It smashed into a million pieces across the post, and Rollins got away, so Kane ate a Superman punch for good measure, and Reigns was left standing tall. I figured Reigns would use the cinder block on Kane and send him away for a couple of months and let him promote his movie that's coming out in October, which I'm planning on seeing, by the way. See No Evil 2. It has Danielle Harris in it. That's all I need to know. The movie could be total shit. If she's in it, I'm watching it. But I guess it's just so important that we have corporate Kane around on television. We can't get rid of the character. If they do Reigns and Rollins at Night of Champions, I'm not sure where that leaves Randy Orton. So maybe Ambrose is able to come back for the pay-per-view. And, you know, maybe they do a tag team match. Roman Reigns and Dean Ambrose against Seth Rollins and Randy Orton. I could see that. Slater Gator, which I thought was a one-and-done tag team. At least that's what Titus O'Neil had said in an interview on WWE.com weeks ago. That's the last time I trust anything I read on that website. And it's weird, too, because I did an interview for Brad Gilmore's podcast, which I want to thank him again for having me on. We taped the interview last Sunday, a couple of hours after I wrapped up recording the sound off, and the interview dropped on Tuesday, so the day after Raw, but during the interview, I made a comment. We were talking about tag teams in WWE, and I think he brought up Slater Gator, and I said, well, you know, Slater Gator's not really a team. It was they got put together one night, I think, at a house show, or maybe a TV taping is like a makeshift team, but Titus O'Neil was on the website saying, nah, they're not really a team, and it's fine. And then the next frickin' night on Raw, there they are. And when was the last time Slater Gator made an appearance on Raw? But there they were the next night, made me look like an idiot, so last time I trust anything I read on WWE.com. Anyway, they got beat by the Matadors, who are back together. I guess random Matador number one finally healed from his injury, so now he's back. Bo Dallas pinned Kofi Kingston in a quick match. Again, Kofi, all by himself. Still a loser. Maybe their little faction will come to TV at some point. Maybe it won't. It doesn't matter. They've already lost me. I just don't care. I hope it works out, and I hope they get to TV, and it's something for Kofi and Big E and Xavier Woods to do, and they're entertaining, and it makes them money. I hope all of that happens, but I don't care anymore. If they do the faction, great. If they don't do the faction, it doesn't faze me at all. You know, that's what happens. That's what happens when you start a storyline on television that gets people buzzing and gets people interested, and then you do nothing to follow up on that. You lose people like me. That's what happens. Jack Swagger came out after the match and suplexed Dallas, which got him some boos. Funny how that works when a guy loses all the time. John Cena versus Bray Wyatt in the main event. Here's the deal. Was Bray Wyatt buried on this show? That's been the big discussion all week long. Wyatt got buried by John Cena. I would have said no, Because, again, buried is a word that gets thrown around way too often. You don't hear me use that word very often on this podcast for that reason. I defy you to go back and find me five different segments where I said so-and-so is buried. Okay? You won't find too many of those. I would have said no until that last attitude adjustment at the end of the show. That was just unnecessary. That was tacking on for the sake of tacking on. And for the people who say, well, John Cena was supposed to look tough. They were telling the story that John Cena is now take no prisoners. He's ready for Brock Lesnar. He's got to look tough, and he's beating everybody up. I don't know what's so tough about having Big Show and Mark Henry, two big dudes, throw Bray Wyatt back in the ring so John Cena can give them a fireman's carry. And I have to say, I found this whole thing to be most disrespectful to Chris Jericho. Jericho came back. He wanted to work with Wyatt. Help him out in any way that he could. They had that first match at Battleground that I didn't think was anything special. They came back at SummerSlam, which was better. And Wyatt got a clean win over the guy. They're likely headed for one more match at Night of Champions. I presume Wyatt wins before Jericho leaves again. Wyatt has lost a lot of steam since his feud, ironically, with John Cena. And Jericho's been doing his part to help him regain some of that momentum, get back on track. And to see what they did here to the guy, I can only imagine what Chris Jericho must really be thinking while he's watching this. And for his part, there are reports that came out, I think they started on PW Insider, that John Cena actually argued against that finish, or at least he argued against laying out Bray at the end like that. But he was overruled by Vince McMahon. It was a Vince McMahon call. He felt that after the beating that Cena took at SummerSlam, people would start to lose faith in him unless he came back looking strong, which I think is complete bullshit. Cena is bulletproof at this point. He is Teflon. John Cena getting beaten down that way by Brock Lesnar and not immediately springing back to life is not going to kill John Cena. That just comes off to me as Vince McMahon being completely freaked out that his golden goose, you know, may lose some of that luster. And again, it comes back to WWE being afraid. They're afraid to lose John Cena. They're banking everything on this one guy. 10 years later, they're still banking everything on this guy. And to me, that's an indictment on their inability to build up another John Cena in the last 10 years. And now they're going to try to do it with Roman Reigns, and I hope it works out. Roman Reigns is the prototypical guy. I could see him being the next big star. Maybe it's Dean Ambrose. Who knows? I hope it works out, and I hope they could finally get that next person, because Cena's not getting any younger, and he's all beat up, and he's 37 years old, and he's not going to be around forever. But if that's what happened here, and if that's the mentality they have, then boy, that's on Vince McMahon. You had 10 freaking years to build up somebody, who can be at that same level and sell merchandise, and I guess CM Punk maybe was the closest thing, and he walked out, but, you know, even Punk, earlier this year, end of last year, Punk lost a lot of luster. He wasn't quite at that level. I think most people would say that CM Punk was, you know, positioned one level below John Cena on the food chain. But that's on them. If that's what Vince McMahon is so worried about, then he needs to look in the mirror. And again, to his credit, John Cena apparently tried to argue against the finish, but he's a company guy, and so whatever the boss wants, he's going to do what his boss tells him to do. He'll only fight so much before he throws his hands in the air and says, all right, boss, I'll do whatever you want me to do. But it sounds like at least he had the common sense to think, you know what, we don't need to be doing this to Bray Wyatt at the end. It's one thing for me to lay out Harper and lay out Rowan. They lose all the time anyway. They're his surrogates. They're the hangers-on to Bray Wyatt. But to lay out the guy himself at the end for no good reason. No reason at all for him to have done that. But that's what Vince wanted. And if I'm Chris Jericho, I'm just looking at this going, what the fuck, man? What are you doing? It's like Fandango. He didn't want to work with Fandango. That was not his first choice. He wanted to work with Ryback. But they made Jericho and Fandango for WrestleMania last year. And Jericho, at the end of the day, said when Vince has his mind set, he's set. And in mind, he said, all right, I'm going to make this work. We're going to try to get this guy over. And he put him over. At WrestleMania 29, Chris Jericho lost to Fandango. Think about that for a second. Let that sink into your brain. And Fandango, it looked like maybe he was on track to being Intercontinental Champion. I remember Steve Austin on his podcast said, 6 months, this guy's going to be the Intercontinental Champion. Give it 6 months. And then he got concussed. And that was the end of Fandango. You know, he's done stuff since, but nothing at any sort of meaningful level where you could take the guy seriously. So Chris Jericho's probably looking at that going, well, that was a waste of time. Vince McMahon wants to make John Cena look strong heading into Night of Champions, yet the old man doesn't realize that by bringing Cena back on the show without any signs whatsoever of trauma from the match at SummerSlam, which was only a week earlier, not a scratch on him, not a bruise, he's not limping, he's not favoring his neck, nothing. It's just Super Cena laying out three dudes all by himself. So in other words, it's the same old John Cena character. It just completely undoes what Lesnar did to this guy at SummerSlam. You know, the match was brief. Cena was throwing White around with suplexes like Brock did to him. Bray hardly got any offense in at all, which brought in Harper and Rowan for the DQ. Big Show and Mark Henry ran down. And by the way, what happened to following up on the Mark Henry Rusev stuff from the week before? What the hell was that for? No mention of that at all on this show. So they come down, they cut to commercial, we come back. Now it's turned into a six-man tag. It was a match. Nothing more, nothing less. Cena submitted Luke Harper with the STF for the win. He followed that with an AA on Eric Rowan. Then an AA to Harper for good measure. And then came the coup de grace, which was Big Show and Mark Henry grabbing Bray Wyatt on the outside, throwing him into the ring, throwing the guy to the lions, and Cena delivering an AA to him to add insult to injury. It's an insult to Jericho, who's in a program still with the guy right now, and we go off the air with John Cena standing tall, looking none the worse for wear. I hated the ending. I hated the show. And condensed to an hour, like I said earlier, this show may have been fine. Without the Bella stuff and without the Wyatt thing at the end that they did there, at 2 hours, it would have been just bad. At 3 hours, it was awful. It was just a bad show, a bad week. Now they have to regroup and come back and actually give us a good show, and a show that will hopefully get us excited to see John Cena versus Brock Lesnar at Night of Champions, and excited for some of the other matches on the card as well. I'm curious how they follow up on the Goldust Stardust heel turn, what's next in the Paige AJ feud, which has taken a very weird turn of late, and what's next for Bray Wyatt and Chris Jericho. Jericho was not on the show this week. Randy Orton, I think, was on vacation. Both are going to be back on Monday. In fact, Jericho's having Orton on as part of his highlight reel segment, so obviously, they'll do something to further the Jericho-Wyatt feud, and hopefully they can, you know, wash the taste out of people's mouths on the Wyatt stuff, because, you know, what they did to him there at the end, it just never should have happened. NXT opened with our final Ascension squash before their title defense at TakeOver. They'll meet the winners of this week's tournament final between the Vaude Villains and Sin Cara and Kalisto. They beat two guys quick. I didn't get their names. They cut a promo when the match was over. Not really much to it. The new general manager of NXT was announced. It is William Regal. And he definitely has previous management experience on his resume. Former WWF commissioner, Raw general manager. It's bittersweet for me because I assume that spells the end of Regal on commentary, and he, if he appears as often as JBL did as the GM, then we're not going to be seeing him very often, and that makes me sad. He called out Adrian Neville, who wanted to know who his next challenger would be for the championship. This brought out Tyson Kidd, Tyler Breeze, Sami Zayn, all interrupted. They each wanted a shot at the title. Neville cut him off and said, you know what, I'm going to defend against all four of you guys. So Regal made the match a four-way for the championship at TakeOver. Not too bright, that Adrian Neville. You know, it's one thing to ask for a four-way, but a four-way in WWE where you don't even have to be the one to get pinned to lose your title, I always thought that was stupid. And that's the situation now that he has put himself in. Bayley and Sasha Banks, I feel like we've seen this match a lot lately. Sasha beat the crap out of her. Bayley won with a belly-to-belly suplex out of nowhere for the pin. She really nailed her with it, too. Probably the most impressive suplex I've seen her throw so far. This brought out Charlotte, who Bayley will challenge for the women's title at TakeOver. Charlotte is clearly patterning herself after her father on promos, which is probably a good idea. Now she stops midway through to chastise the crowd and tell them to shut up. I was waiting for her to call the woman in the front row fatty and threaten to make a man out of her husband, but sadly she didn't do that. We saw a serious side of Bayley here. She promised to win the title. She said, you know what? I'm not even interested in giving you a hug. And that got more of a reaction out of the crowd at Full Sail than Nikki Bella's line about, I hope you die in the womb. Why is Bayley down in developmental and those two are on TV? It just blows my mind. I guess we know why, but I know, stupid question. Bayley put her hand out for a handshake. Charlotte just walked away, and so that's the setup for their match at TakeOver. Bull Dempsey and Angelo Dawkins. This was a classic squash right out of the days of Superstars and Wrestling Challenge. Bull came out. They aired an inset promo with him talking about beating up Mojo Rawley at TakeOver. He took most, but not all, of the match. Dawkins got some offense in on him. But in the end, the match was meant to be a showcase for the guy that they're actually pushing, which in this case is Bull Dempsey, and he won with his bulldozer body slam. Just very simple formula, like I said, just out of the old days, very effective, I think, in that way. That's how you build a guy for a singles match on your next big show. So I thought this was fine for what it was. Main event was Adrian Neville and Sami Zayn against Tyson Kidd and Tyler Breeze. A fine match. Tyson Kidd has been a revelation on this show. It just makes them look so bad that they couldn't come up with this for the guy on Raw when he came back from his injury. He was out for like a year with, I think he had reconstructive surgery on his knee. And he comes back, you know, when his wife is on that Total Divas show. And so I'm sure he gets a decent amount of screen time on there, as all of the people do on Total Divas. It's one of the only things, I'm sure, getting half of them any television time at all. And I'm sure for that reason we'll see Rosa Mendez popping up on Raw and SmackDown soon enough. But you would think, like, he came back from the injury, and, you know, they did something with him for a little bit. He was on television for like 2 weeks, and then he just disappeared again. You know, there's no reason he couldn't be doing this gimmick on TV, but they didn't do it. I'll take it on NXT. It's better than nothing. Finish came when Neville went up top with a red arrow. He got crotched by Tyler Breeze. Sami Zayn then comes from out of nowhere with a Yakuza kick. Breeze ducked out of the way, so unfortunately he struck his partner Neville with the kick. Pretty wicked kick, too. Zayn gets tossed out of the ring. Kidd tags himself in, gets the pin on the champion, then he celebrates like he won the lottery. I could watch these four wrestle every week. You wouldn't get a complaint out of me. We saw a different side of Sami Zayn here. He came back into the ring when the match was over. He gave Tyson Kidd the kick in a fit of rage, knocked him out. Then he picked up the championship and held it up as everybody in the arena did the ole ole chant. So TakeOver should be great. Card as it currently stands for September the 11th looks like this. We have Bull Dempsey against Mojo Rawley. Hair versus hair match. Enzo Amore against Sylvester Lefort. Tag team titles on the line with the Ascension defending against either the Vaudevillains or Sin Cara and Kalisto, depending on who wins the tag team tournament this week. Charlotte defending her women's title against Bayley, and Adrian Neville defending the championship against Tyson Kidd, Sami Zayn, and Tyler Breeze. That is a show that I am looking forward to. 2 hours, September 11th on the WWE Network for just... Oh, what's the price? I forgot about the... What is the price of the network anyway? I can't seem to remember. Thank you guys for taking time out of your day to listen to The Sound Off. I get questions from people asking, how can I support the podcast? Well, the best way to support the show is simple. Just keep listening each and every week. Keep spreading the word about it to friends and family and retweet or share links to the episodes on Twitter and Facebook. But beyond that, you can contribute by making a PayPal donation or by signing up for a free 30-day trial of the Audible.com service. Making a PayPal donation is simple. Just log on to thesolomonster.com and you'll see the PayPal donation box on the right-hand side of the page. Enter whatever amount you'd like and click the Make a Donation button. That's it. Or sign up for a free Audible trial by entering our custom URL, audibletrial.com/solomonster. From there, you can sign up free for 30 days, which helps us out. You get one free audiobook as part of your trial that you get to keep no matter what. You can browse through their library of over 150,000 titles. Listen to your books at home, on the commute to work, at the gym, whenever, wherever. Sign up at audibletrial.com/solomonster or visit thesolomonster.com to make a donation right now. And thank you for supporting The Sound Off. Time to talk TNA. News came out this past week that if things don't work out between TNA and Spike TV, and they have to find a new home, and with Spike, it's looking more and more grim each passing week without a new deal announced. They may have a new home if they want to take a deal from the Velocity Channel. Now, for those of you wondering, well, what is the Velocity Channel? That's you and I both asking that question, because before this week, I had never heard of the Velocity Channel before. Apparently, it's some network for men. They have cars and racing and all that kind of stuff. And clearly, it is not available in as many homes as Spike TV. It's a network not many people have even heard of. And look, it's better than nothing, I suppose. If TNA gets shut out by Spike and they have nowhere to go, they die. At least if they find some network somewhere, it's some stay of execution at least. They could try to make it work. Although, like I said, if they're not getting as much money from them as they are from Spike, and they're clearly having money issues, and we'll get to that more in a second, I don't really know what good that does TNA. It's almost like prolonging the inevitable. And I've read that Spike is paying anywhere from $13 to $15 million a year for Impact. Okay, that hasn't been confirmed anywhere, but that seems to be the belief. It's somewhere in that $13 to $15 million range per year. If let's say this offer, this supposed offer from Velocity, is for a quarter of that, which is what the reports are saying, the money isn't good, they're offering around a quarter of what their current Spike deal is. If that's the case, plus TNA, remember, they have to pay UTA, the talent agency that they contracted with to help find them a new TV home, they have to pay them a portion of whatever deal they get from whatever network, then that doesn't leave TNA with very much. Now, a little over 50 million homes seemingly have access to this channel, which works out to just over half of what Spike has. And, you know, to put that in perspective here, that would only be slightly higher of a percentage than those who have access right now to Ring of Honor TV. And it's also HD only, which I was not aware of. And that means people like me, who don't have HD, would be screwed. And there are still plenty of people out there who do not, in fact, have HD. So that's another segment of the audience that you're shutting out if they end up on that channel. So it's not good for TNA. You know, the fact that they're even considering that or have to consider that. And again, TMZ is not retracting its earlier report from months ago when they came out and said that Spike had made the decision to cancel Impact. They still maintain that nothing has changed. Spike's position is still the same. They have given TNA until the end of the year, at least. They said, listen, Impact will continue to air on Spike through the end of 2014. That's very nice of them to do, but that's not the same thing as a new TV deal. And so they're in a really bad situation right now. TNA is a real bad position. They have no house show scheduled, I don't believe, beyond... they may have some shows scheduled in September, but beyond that, there are no house shows, I guess, until the European tour that they usually do in January. There's nothing on the schedule. And they've got a Bound for Glory pay-per-view in Japan October 12, and they've got so much TV coming up next month that they're going to be taping. You wonder how they're going to reconcile that, because there's going to be shows that will not air until after Bound for Glory. So how do you avoid spoilers? How do you... You know, I don't know. I don't know how they're going to work that out, but they're going to have to logistically figure out a way. Because they're still going to Japan. They're still doing the show. They're still claiming Team 3D is going into the Hall of Fame, and the situation with Bully Ray has not been resolved. It has not changed. I don't know if he's talking to TNA still or not. I would imagine they're probably still talking. They're probably still trying to work something out, but there's been nothing new to report. Bully has not come out to refute the reports, which I think probably tells you everything you need to know there as far as how true it all is. Maybe they can work something out, maybe not, but TNA is still planning to put them in the Hall of Fame in October, even if he's not there. And they also let go of several office people this week, which goes to the point I was making before about the money, how important that TV money is to this company. You know, a bunch of marketing and PR people have left. They fired Jimmy Jay, who was the merchandise guy that replaced Don West when he left the company. They also fired Dewey Barnes. Remember Dewey Barnes? They paraded him out there as a job guy on TV to get beat like 6 weeks in a row by EC3. His real job was with their merchandise department. They just shit-canned him, too. Dewey Barnes. Now who will I not give a shit about in this company? He was my go-to guy. So, Impact on Wednesday. Again, I was there at these tapings. I already went over the spoilers on the Sound Off a few weeks ago, so these are just some quick thoughts and observations having seen it play out now on TV. Kurt Angle opened the show in the balcony, said that after last week's cage match where Bobby Roode and Eric Young hit the floor at the same time, he would sit down with them to work out a conclusion. You had all week to do that, buddy. Well, I guess actually he had 20 minutes since this was taped right after that cage match, but you know what I mean. MVP Lashley and Kenny King came out. MVP declared Lashley the King of New York. This brought out Tommy Dreamer, who referred to Lashley as, and I quote, the most dominant world champion this or any company has ever seen. He was so full of shit when he said this, it started leaking out of his eyeballs. You know, Lashley may legit be the best booked champion in TNA history. I would go so far as to say that. And that includes Jeff Jarrett in the early days. You could say, oh, he was booked strong too. He was champion for so long and everything else. You know, but Jarrett had to cheat and he had to use the guitar and he was made to look like a pussy, kind of chicken shit heel most of the time. Just in terms of the way that the champion himself, heel or face, and in this case he's a heel, is being booked, I dare you to find me another champion who was booked as strongly as Lashley. I mean, Samoa Joe was champion at one time. I don't recall him having that long of a reign, but maybe Joe would be up there. Again, I wasn't watching TNA as much during that period. I know, you know, he was as over as anybody back then, and him and Kurt Angle had some great matches. But, you know, month to month, Lashley is, if he's not number one, he's way up there. I will give them that. But when you say something stupid like that, like what Dreamer said here, the fans see right through it. And whatever credibility Dreamer may have had with them went right out the window, as evidenced by some of the boos he got when he said that. Kenny King jumped Dreamer, threw him out of the ring. He grabbed a kendo stick. One thing led to another. Angle made Dreamer versus Lashley in a New York City street fight, which was really just a way to showcase Lashley against a guy they could beat without any real consequences since he's not a full-time member of the roster. Although it sure feels that way with all the appearances and TV time this guy's been getting on their show. Lashley beat him with a spear. Is there a more overused finish in wrestling than the spear? Not counting the distraction roll-up? Shoot me some ideas here because I'm failing to come up with any. Taryn Terrell beat Madison Rayne with a stunner. Not a good match. I wonder if part of the problem with Taryn is that this is her first time, really, these last few weeks, working in the six-sided ring. So she's still getting used to it. Either that or Gail Kim is like Ric Flair with Lex Luger at the 88 Great American Bash and is just that damn good at making other people look good. That's possible, too, because Gail Kim is great. Low-key, Tigre Uno and Crazy Steve beat Homicide, DJ Zima, and Matic. Six-man tag team X Division action. These guys were all over the place. I had fun watching it. Key pinned Matic with the Key Crusher for the win. Bobby Roode and Eric Young had an in-ring segment. Next week, they face each other to determine the number one contender for Lashley's TNA World Heavyweight title. They're playing up that the two of them have been best friends for years and years and years. In fact, did you know the two of them worked a WWF match together against the FBI one time on Velocity? The show, not the network that they may end up on.
And at a combined weight of 455 pounds, Eric Young and Bobby Roode.
Feels weird to hear Chimmel announcing those guys' names. Rhino and EC3 had a match. It was a bad match. No better than it was live when I watched it back here on TV. Every time Rhino would set up for the gore, Rockstar Spud would hold his foot and stop him. EC3 gave Rhino a nut shot, went for the pin, but he kicked out. So EC3 grabbed the chair, he walloped Rhino with it for the DQ, and then he just obliterated him with chair shot after chair shot after chair shot, left him laying. It was a more aggressive side of EC3 than we've seen before. I like that. I like that character progression, but as a match, it was no good. James Storm brings out the great Sonata, now wearing face paint just like his mentor, the great Muda. He pinned Austin Aries in a good match. James Storm crotched Aries on the top rope when he was setting up for the 450. Sonata blew green mist in Aries' eyes behind the referee's back. Brian Hebner had to pretend not to know what just happened, despite the fact that Aries had green mist all over his face and Sonata had green mist dripping down from his chin. That, I thought, was stupid. We had probably the best segment on the entire show. Main event was really good, too, but this, as a segment, this was really great. The introduction of Sergeant Chris Melendez. I mentioned when I was there, they had handed out little tiny American flags before the segment for us to wave around. And this guy came out. He got a great reaction. He seems to have a great presence about him. He's a pretty tall guy, too. I mean, I don't know for sure. I would guess maybe 6'1", 6'2", somewhere in that range. They had Kurt Angle in the ring to introduce him. Team 3D was in there, as was Mr. Anderson. I was not aware that Mr. Anderson was a military man. He talked a little bit about that and finding out from somebody he knew at his favorite charity, which is the Wounded Warrior Project, that there was this guy who had been wounded in Iraq, lost a leg, who wanted to be a professional wrestler. And Anderson said, well, I don't train people, but I know two guys who do. They're the two best trainers in the entire world. That's what he said. Bully Ray and D-Von, who were in the ring, and they talked about, you know, finding out about this kid and meeting with him and then agreeing to train him for free because they knew how serious he was about it and they didn't feel right charging him money after all the sacrifice that he made for his country. It made for a nice, like, heartwarming story. People were into it. They were respectful of it. And we'll see what the guy's got. You know, he's now officially a member of the TNA roster. You know, TNA got a lot of local publicity for it here in New York. I don't know how they view it, if they view him more as just an attraction, or if they're going to give him an opportunity like everybody else on the roster has an opportunity. We'll see, but it was a very classy segment and probably the best thing on the entire show. And then came the main event. It was a three-way first match in the series between Team 3D, the Wolves, and the Hardys. First team to win two matches will be the TNA Tag Team Champions. Team 3D wins match number one. They end up delivering a 3D to Eddie Edwards in the end to get the pin. A lot of action, a lot of dives. Jeff Hardy doing his sick dive out of the ring at one point onto everybody. Too many moves for me to go through here, but it was a really good match. It was a really good match. It was as I remembered it. I wasn't there for match number two and match number three, which were the stip matches, table match and ladder match, respectively. I heard those were also really good. So at least we know we have some good action to look forward to on Impact, at least in the main event, over the next few weeks. I can't speak to other stuff like the Beautiful People and Sam Shaw and all that kind of garbage. You know, for all the good stuff, there still is some bad stuff on the show. But generally speaking, the shows have been better. The shows have been good. And it's hard not to be when you have these three teams in the ring together going at it. And you have the X Division guys and Homicide in there and Low-Key in there and Manic, who I'm a big fan of, in there doing their thing. You're almost guaranteed to have at least a good show in terms of wrestling. And you know what? I'll say this much. There was a lot better wrestling on this show this week in terms of in-ring action than we got on Raw Monday night. I give the edge to TNA this week. At least there was nothing on this show that made me angry or made me feel like I had just wasted 2 hours of my life. That's all you could really ask for. So I give Impact a thumbs up this week. I thought it was a good show. Let's move on to the mailbag. If you have questions, you can email them to me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from, but at least your name. Some people still don't do that. You could also send MP3 questions as audio attachments if you would like to do so. This comes from Trevor. I was watching the second episode of the Monday Night War. Eric Bischoff said that Sting was supposed to be the third man in the NWO until Hulk Hogan called an audible. Do you think the business would have been as hot if Sting was the leader rather than Hogan? Well, I don't think... Let's just go back a little bit here. I don't know that it was Hogan calling an audible. The story, as it was always told, was Hogan was not sold on the idea at first. I think Bischoff came to him, and Hogan was still very reluctant because Hogan had been the red and yellow for so long. He had been the babyface hero in WWE. Even at the end there, when people were kind of starting to turn on him a little bit, he left shortly thereafter, but they never turned him heel. He came to WCW. They gave him a ticker tape parade. He was the big babyface guy, and he brought in all of his friends, all of the big guys, helped get them jobs so he can beat them, guys like Earthquake and Brutus Beefcake and Kamala, all these big dudes that Hogan could come in and just beat them. And him and Savage certainly beat a lot of people. If you go back to 1995, that was a horrible year for wrestling. And not just in WCW, in WWE as well. So now we're bleeding into 96, and Hogan, I think, had been gone for a few months. Maybe he was filming a movie or a TV show or something, and I had always been of the impression that Bischoff really had to sell him on the idea. He was not all gung-ho about it at first because he was worried about, you know, harming his image or his merchandise sales or whatever. And essentially, he had to be talked into it. And so, yes, in the end, he made the call. He agreed to do it. And would the business have been as hot if it was staying? No. It would have changed everything. I think I think wrestling was bound to get hot to a point no matter what, but would it have had the same effect with Sting or anybody else really in that spot instead of Hogan? No, I don't think it would have worked. Or it wouldn't have worked for nearly as long as it did. It had to be Hogan. Hogan was the biggest star in wrestling. The biggest name, the most recognizable name, and a guy who had not been a villain since before he really hit it big with that Hulkamania thing in the mid-80s. I mean, he was a heel early on in his career. He was a heel in the AWA. So it's not like he had never played the bad guy before, but from the moment Hulkamania took off and he won that first world championship and beat the Iron Sheik, he had been the all-American, bread-and-butter, babyface, white meat hero. And nothing else. And all those years later now, here we are, you know, 12 years later, whatever it is, and now you're going to turn this guy into a villain and he's going to start healing on the crowd and calling them, you know, idiots. And it was a big deal. I was a loyal WWF fan at the time. I would only flip casually on Monday nights. I wasn't ordering WCW pay-per-views or anything. And I remember the very next day, I was a camp counselor at the time. And I remember going to work, and there were a few other friends of mine who worked there as well who were also wrestling fans, and they told me what happened with Hogan. Because, you know, back then I couldn't just go to a website that night on the internet and find out. And I was like, whoa, really? And I had to watch, you know, the next show to find out. I wanted to see it. I wanted to see the footage. I wanted to know what happened. So they got me interested because I had grown up, as a lot of people did, as a Hulk Hogan fan. There's a lot of people who are wrestling fans right now, whether you like the guy or not, who would not be fans if it wasn't for Hulk Hogan. That is the truth. And it was a big, big deal when he turned heel. Having Sting do the same thing, Sting is not the same star that Hulk Hogan is. He wasn't then, and he isn't now. It would not have had the same effect. What effect then it would have had on the WWE, it's impossible to say. You know, if it was Sting instead of Hogan, it wouldn't have stopped the ascent of Steve Austin. I think things probably would have happened just as they did. But maybe not. Because the Hogan heel turn happened in 96, and that's what really gave WCW the kick in the ass they needed to just start beating WWE week after week after week in the ratings. And it all goes back to Hogan linking up with Hall and Nash. If that doesn't happen, then maybe it doesn't create the level of competition that there was between the two companies, and maybe it doesn't light a fire under Vince McMahon's ass, and maybe Steve Austin doesn't get the kind of push he ended up getting. You know, it's so impossible to say, but I can definitely tell you unequivocally it would not have had the same effect with Sting in that spot as it did with Hogan. Not even close. This question comes from Alvin, and it's a good one. So good that after I responded to him directly, I sent him an email. I immediately second-guessed my answer and emailed him back and said, hold that thought, I may talk about this on the podcast. He says, 5 years from now, looking back, which of the two would you think will have had the biggest impact on wrestling? Hulk Hogan joining the NWO, which changed the landscape of wrestling and birthed an era of mainstream wrestling that likely won't be seen again, or Triple H marrying Stephanie McMahon instead of Test on that one episode of Raw, which was the starting point of their real-life relationship and eventual marriage. Asking a few people, I've gotten multiple opinions about this and wanted yours. And that is a great question. When you look back on the history of wrestling, which one of those two events, which one of those two angles that led to real-life consequences, okay, Hogan joining the NWO led to an explosion in the popularity of wrestling, Triple H marrying Stephanie McMahon, which started out as an angle, turned into a real-life marriage. That's going to have a longer-lasting impact on wrestling, I think, than the NWO. That was my first answer to Alvin. I went with Triple H marrying Stephanie, but then I kind of stopped myself. Because if Hogan doesn't join the NWO, let's say, to go back to the last question, it's Sting. Some lower-level guy, even just one level below Hogan. If the NWO doesn't get as hot, or last as long as it did, which was years. We're not talking about an angle that went for a year or for 6 months. The NWO, which by the end was completely watered down, they were still doing NWO Black and White and NWO Wolfpack shit in 1999. That's how long that thing went on for. They rode that wave until there was no water left to ride. So if Hogan joining doesn't happen, and that doesn't happen, where does that leave wrestling? Where does that leave the WWF and people getting pushed like Steve Austin and Rocky Maivia and Mankind and everything that happened there on that product, and even Triple H as part of DX. Everything that happened, you know, could have been connected to the NWO getting popular, because that's what really led to tough times for WWE, almost going bankrupt in 97, as Vince McMahon has talked about, and it led to that creative shift, to the Attitude Era, to the shocking stuff that they ended up doing heading into 1998. If that doesn't happen, where the hell does that leave wrestling today? What does wrestling look like now if the Attitude Era never happened? Is WWE still in business? Would they have gone out of business? That's an even better question. Now, one of the things that led to them being able to come back and not have to file for bankruptcy, and I think I've told this story before, was the shift to 3-hour pay-per-views every month and charging full price for them. Because WWF had the in-your-house shows. Usually the in-your-house pay-per-views were only 2 hours. They were priced a little bit lower. In September of 97, that was the Ground Zero in-your-house show. That was the first full-time, 3-hour in-your-house pay-per-view. They made the move, they made the shift, and it was a huge success. Because people didn't stop buying the shows because all of a sudden they're full price. If anything, more people started to buy the shows, probably because they felt like, okay, now these shows are important. You know, they're not the bitch of the monthly pay-per-views. And they liked what they were seeing, and so people were buying the shows, and all of a sudden WWF went to Bret Hart and said, hey, you know what we said about not being able to pay you on that 20-year contract? We can pay you now. And by then it was too late, because Bret had already negotiated a deal with Eric Bischoff and WCW, and we all know what happened after that. But the point is, WCW did a lot of those things first, and WWF would then piggyback on them. So, you know, WCW was the first one really to start doing those monthly pay-per-views. And they were the ones who expand Nitro from 1 hour to two, and then eventually 2 hours to three. There were a lot of things that WWF was late in the game on. They were just following WCW's lead. Well, if WCW doesn't get hot the way they did off the NWO stuff, it really, I mean, it's a scary question to think about, but would Vince McMahon have been able to turn things around like he did in 1997, or would it have been too late? And would they have gone public and become as big as they did now? I don't know that they do. I don't know that they do. And so that's why I had to go back and kind of stop myself, because Triple H and Stephanie, you hope, you know, they're in love, that's all well and good, and hopefully they'll stay together and be happily married for the rest of their lives. Assuming that's the case, they're going to be together for a long, long time, and Vince is not going to be around forever. Some people think he will, maybe as a cyborg, but let's assume he isn't. It seems like Triple H is going to be the one to kind of take his spot, him and Stephanie both, to run the company or creative and whatever. Although, Vince has made the comment before that he would like to envision the company not being a family business. He would like to bring other executives from outside the company in to run things long term. Vince said that in a Forbes interview. So I don't know what Vince's plans are for the future, but it sure looks like Triple H will, in a lot of ways, take his spot when Vince steps down or he dies or whatever happens. And the vision that Triple H has for what the company should be and for what the on-air product should look like. And there have been glimmers of hope, because I like what Triple H has done with NXT. Every now and then stories will come out, you know, whether you believe them or not, that he, you know, will fight Vince tooth and nail on certain ideas that seem to make sense, and in the end Vince wins out. I mean, I think there's a lot to look forward to in terms of Triple H kind of running the show when it comes to that. I mean, we don't know for sure until it actually happens. If that happens, though, his vision is going to be the vision for that company for maybe decades to come. So maybe it's just a question that's too early to ask. You said 5 years from now, if we look back, maybe we need to look back 20 years from now and ask that same question. Because right now, I'm thinking that the Hogan move to join the NWO may have had the bigger impact. I mean, just the way things are done right now in wrestling. The formula that we see every Monday night on Raw, okay, which is just ridiculous, and I wish they would freshen things up and just change things up a little bit. But a lot of the things they still do to this day in wrestling, all of that stemmed from changes they made back during the Attitude Era when they were in competition with WCW, and the Monday night shows became must-see TV and not just another show that was on the air during the week. they still follow a lot of those same formulas in production, you know, all of that stuff. Even the look of the show and the stage and the set and the Titantron and the way they do promos and all of that kind of stuff. It all goes back to that 1996, 1997, 1998 period. And if that never happened, if you take that away, it's a valid question. You know, what the hell does wrestling look like today? Is it better? Is it worse? Is the company even still around? Because their fortunes didn't change until after that happened. So I would lean towards Hogan joining the NWO as having the bigger, you know, the bigger impact of the two things right now. But you'd have to ask the same question 20 years from now and how Triple H and Stephanie have changed things to truly see the effects of it. You know, we hear that Triple H is not a fan of Kevin Dunn. Kevin Dunn is a Vince McMahon guy. Well, what we see on television every week is from the vision of Kevin Dunn because he's the head production guy there. And what we see pumped out on television every week is what he envisions the show to be. Well, if Vince goes away and Triple H says, adios, Kevin Dunn, and brings in somebody completely new to run the show, maybe the show will look and feel fresher. Maybe it'll look different. Maybe the way they shoot certain things and camera angles and the product 10 years from now may look drastically different than it does now, and I might have a different answer to that question. But right now, I would lean towards Hogan joining the NWO. Austin from Michigan, after listening to your list of possible opponents for Brock Lesnar on last week's podcast, I was wondering, with Jeff Hardy's contract coming up in early 2015, could we see Hardy versus Brock? If not, who could Hardy feud with? And could we also see a Brock Lesnar face turn and feud with Triple H? God, I hope not. Triple H was a terrible opponent for Brock Lesnar. Their matches were just ungodly boring. But to go back to your Jeff Hardy question first, if TNA survives into 2015, I see Hardy staying put. I think he likes it there. I think he likes the freedom that he has there and the time off. I do think he'll end up back in WWE at some point. He, like a lot of other guys, Bully Ray, have done interviews recently, and they get asked the same question. And Hardy has never said no. In fact, he made a comment about how it would be great to go back to his creatures because he knows they miss him, and he'll be back. He will definitely be back in WWE one day. I just don't think it's going to be that soon. If he did, I don't see Jeff Hardy against Brock Lesnar. I just don't think that happens. What I would like to see, though, Jeff Hardy against Seth Rollins, I think could be a hell of a feud. Jeff Hardy against Bray Wyatt is another one. Jeff Hardy had some awesome matches with Umaga, who's a slightly bigger guy. I think a feud with Hardy and Wyatt could make for some real good matches, similar to the way Hardy and Umaga had a chemistry together. But you mentioned turning Brock Lesnar babyface. I got another email, and I want to give him credit for it. Dave in Arkansas, who pitched the following idea, and I want to share it with everybody right now because I think it's a really intriguing idea. He says, Lesnar stays champion until WrestleMania, and Roman Reigns wins the Royal Rumble. Seeing how WWE repeats history all too often, Paul Heyman then turns on Brock Lesnar at WrestleMania like he did at Survivor Series back in 2002 when he helped Big Show win the title from Brock. Since Lesnar would be on his way out of WWE anyway, Heyman would prefer to side with a younger, up-and-coming star like Roman Reigns and cast Brock aside. It would then be revealed the following night that it was a plan by the Authority. Reigns would turn heel and be the, quote, corporate champion like The Rock back in 98. Seth Rollins, like Mick Foley in that same storyline, would feel slighted and underappreciated by Triple H and Stephanie. This could turn Rollins babyface for a feud with Reigns, culminating in Rollins cashing in his Money in the Bank contract and becoming champion, cementing him as a top star. I hate the idea of splitting up Heyman and Lesnar, but the idea of doing a double turn at Mania with Reigns winning the belt and becoming a Paul Heyman guy is intriguing to me. I actually think it's a good idea. I'm not saying I would definitely do it. I'm just saying if I was thinking outside the box of ideas, and if I knew Brock was leaving, so if Brock's last date is WrestleMania 31 and they don't sign him to a new deal, or he decides, I'm done, I've had my fun, I'm going to go back to UFC, and it looks like he's really out, I think then at that point, this idea makes sense. I think it would potentially make sense. Now, you're trying to build Roman Reigns up as the next big babyface to possibly take John Cena's spot. that's one of the other problems, I guess, with the idea. You can't build this guy up and build him up and build him up as the next babyface and then turn him heel without having somebody else not named John Cena there to feud with him. Is Seth Rollins that guy? I do see Rollins long-term having, you know, more value as a babyface. I just think he's so spectacular in the ring. People would genuinely like to cheer for the guy. Dean Ambrose is the guy I always saw long-term as being the, like, ultimate heel villain in the company. I would ride the wave with Ambrose as a babyface as long as I possibly can, because he is over right now. He's probably the most over of the three. But I still say down the road, long-term, Ambrose's real future is as a really hardcore, despicable heel up against whoever the top babyface is at the time, probably John Cena. But to go back to this idea here, if Brock does leave, Heyman does the turn, Reigns wins the title, so he gets his big WrestleMania moment, but he becomes a Paul Heyman guy in the process. That would solve the problem of Reigns, in the eyes of some, not being the strongest. And he's not the strongest on promos. He's not great. He's okay. He has his moments. He's not good with scripted material. You know, when I've heard him and seen him kind of off the cuff, he's actually pretty good. But that would solve that problem. If Brock leaves after Mania, you know, the issue is Heyman has nobody left to manage, and that would be a crime for him to go away with Brock. You know, we need Paul Heyman on TV. Paul Heyman has been one of the shining beacons of this television show, especially ever since The Shield broke up. Heyman kind of has, he's not a wrestler, but he's filled that void in a way. His promos are must-see. Week after week, he somehow finds a way to top himself. He's just great at what he does. If Brock stays, which is also possible, it turns him babyface looking for revenge. Kind of the way it did back in 2002, right? Brock was already starting to get cheered. And I think the storyline at the time was that Heyman was finding it more difficult to control the monster he created, and Brock was starting to think for himself. And that's when Heyman knew, and so he plotted against him, and he went with Big Show instead. And then Brock just became full-on badass babyface. I think the same thing would probably happen here. And then what you could do is you could do the deal with Rollins also turning and feuding with Reigns, but I wouldn't have Rollins win. I would keep the belt on Roman Reigns for a while and then feud him with Dean Ambrose for the championship at that point. Or maybe you revisit Reigns and Brock, only with the roles reversed this time, Brock being the babyface and Reigns being the heel. But in your scenario, in Dave's scenario, I do think the real money would be heel Roman Reigns feuding with babyface Dean Ambrose for the championship. I think that could really be a feud that carries the company next year if they wanted to go in that direction. So I'll just leave it at that. I hate the idea of splitting up Brock and Paul because they're so inseparable. You know, together, they're so much better than they are as great as they are individually. Together, they're just unbeatable as a combo. And I really would only entertain the idea if I knew Brock wasn't going to come back and we were going to go with Reigns and Rollins, Reigns and Ambrose, with Reigns being a Paul Heyman guy and Heyman doing most of the talking for him. That's something I would definitely consider. I think that's a hell of an idea. Cole from Philadelphia. So here we are. It's almost September, and between TNA and WWE in 2014, there have been 6 different world championship runs. Brock Lesnar doesn't count since his reign is still in its infancy. Out of those 6 title runs, who do you think was the best book champion and vice versa? I said it earlier, I think the best book champion in TNA maybe ever has been Lashley, so obviously he's the best booked of 2014. I don't think anybody in WWE has been booked stronger than Lashley. You know, Brock may end up that way, but like you said, we're not counting Brock, we're putting him on the side right now. Cena won his 15th title, but he lost it pretty quickly, and there was nothing really memorable about that run. To go to the other flip side of your question, who is the least best booked or the worst booked champion? It's a tie. I mean, I kind of go back and forth here between Magnus, who was booked like a pussy. I've made that very clear. When he was the champion in TNA, he was booked like a pussy, and it didn't work. But Daniel Bryan, as happy as I was to see him win the title and get his big moment at WrestleMania, he got hurt. The timing was bad. The timing sucked. But he wasn't booked very well either as a world champion. He at least, I could say this more than I can for Magnus, Bryan got at least one big clean win on pay-per-view over Kane. They had that match at Extreme Rules. They brawled backstage. They came back out. There was a flaming table, and Brian did a dive off a forklift, which I'm sure did his neck no favors. He at least got that one big win over Kane on pay-per-view, but then they came right back, and they had him running away from Kane. And again, you'll have people who say, he was just protecting his wife, Solomonster. Stop saying that. He still ran the fuck away from Kane. He was booked terribly at that point as a champion. But he had that one big win. So I might give the edge to Magnus a little bit, because Magnus won matches, but he needed help in every single match. Nobody took him seriously. He had good promos, and that was all he had. He had nothing else. It was 4 months, a very forgettable title run. Brian's title run, also very forgettable, marred by injury, running away from people, insulted, called a troll. None of that stopped after he became the champion. It just wasn't a good time for either guy, so I would kind of put those guys on the same plateau, maybe give an edge to Magnus, though. This comes from the composer. Do you think Eric Bischoff deserves a spot in the WWE Hall of Fame? And if so, do you believe he'll one day be inducted? And if he is one day inducted, do you think that opens the gates for people like Vince Russo to one day have a shot at being inducted? I do think Eric Bischoff deserves to be inducted. They've put other people, Vern Gagne's in there. I'm sure Vince himself will one day be inducted, even if he waits until after he's dead. Eric Bischoff, say what you want to, but he had a lasting impact on wrestling. There was a war in the late 90s because of Eric Bischoff. If Eric Bischoff does not go to Ted Turner and say, well, you want to know how we can compete with Vince? Well, here's how. And then getting the TV time for Nitro. If there was no Nitro, there's no Monday Night War. If there's no Monday Night War, I don't know where we are today in terms of pro wrestling in the U.S. Maybe we have a bunch of independents. I don't know. Because business was not exactly booming back then in 1995. He helped change the game. You know, competition's a great thing. Why do you think Raw most weeks sucks? There's no competition. They're not fighting for it. They're not up against anybody. It's just, we have 3 hours of TV we got to fill, and we've already rewritten the show 15 times, so let's go for number 16. And that's why things are the way they are today. And I shouldn't say, you know, Raw doesn't suck every week, but there's far more things on that show that make you just scratch your head and make you ask why, or frustrate you and make you angry. Then there are things that make you go, hey, that was awesome. And it shouldn't be that way. And you got to give Eric Bischoff credit for that. So he absolutely deserves to be inducted. I think one day he will be inducted. And as far as the Vince Russo question, the idea of putting Vince Russo into any wrestling Hall of Fame is laughable to me. But could I see him going into the WWE Hall of Fame one day? You know what? Never say never. It might be less likely once Vince is gone and let's say Triple H is the one making those decisions, because I get the impression, I don't know this, but I get the impression that Triple H may not be a huge Vince Russo fan. But he still had an impact. He did, you know, when he had Vince McMahon as the guy filtering out all of his crappy ideas from the really good ones. And he did have some really good ideas. You know, I wouldn't be surprised to find out that some of the segments I love the most about the Attitude Era that were the most fun may well have been a Vince Russo idea. I don't know that. I don't know if the Zamboni angle back in September of 98 was his idea or not, but I love that segment. I'm not saying that Vince Russo never had a good idea in his life. But what I'm saying is, I think he was far more detrimental to wrestling than he was good for wrestling. But could he be in the Hall of Fame one day? Yeah, I could see that. I could see them putting him in the Hall of Fame. If they start putting in people other than just wrestlers and managers and people like that, I think there's a lot of other deserving people who deserve to be put in far before, long before Vince Russo ever is. And we're talking referees, we're talking people who work behind the scenes, maybe even some production people. It's names that they'll never acknowledge like that because they're not big names. They can't put a video package together for a lot of those people. But I think Ultimate Warrior had a point when he made that comment at the Hall of Fame this year by saying there should be the Jimmy Miranda Award. And Jimmy Miranda was a guy who was very instrumental for a number of years in terms of merchandise behind the scenes in WWE. And, you know, guys going to him and getting their t-shirts sold. You know, he was a very important part of that machine. And Warrior was always big about that, you know, making money and selling merchandise and all that kind of stuff. And I thought it was really cool for him to go out and say that and almost, like, put WWE on the spot. Like, I lay down the gauntlet. Now, if you don't do this, it's going to make you look bad. I think, especially with him dying, it would be a nice little thing in Warrior's honor to actually take him up on that. And starting next year, even if it's one of those things where it's not, you know, you don't make a big deal about it necessarily during the ceremony, but you air a little video package with some clips of the guy and who he was and people explaining how important a role he did play behind the scenes. You know, they'll do that sometimes with like big awards like the Oscars or the Emmys, where they'll honor certain people that you would never know in a million years. And they're kind of the people that put the nuts and bolts together for some of these things. But they at least acknowledge them, even if it's in a smaller category. I think they should start doing that. I think they should call it the Jimmy Miranda Award. I think Warrior was right on with that. But until they start honoring people like that, I don't see a Vince Russo going into the Hall of Fame. And I wouldn't exactly be quick to put him in there either. This comes from James. During Hogan's birthday party, when Lesnar came to the ring and got in Hogan's face, what do you think it would have been like if the ring would have cleared except for Brock, Hogan, Hall, and Nash, and then the NWO squashed Brock and each did their powerbomb, outsider edge, and leg drop, and then spray-painted NWO on his back to end the show? Wow. That's quite an idea. I think it would have gotten a huge pop, and it also would have been one of the single dumbest things they've ever done in the history of that company. I'm glad they did not do what you just described. As though Hogan or Hall could even do their finishing moves anymore. It's like, really? Come on. The funny thing is, you know, for all the flack that Kevin Nash gets for being injury prone and tearing his quad, all the tearing his quad jokes and memes and all that kind of stuff, you know, he tore his quad while sitting on the toilet straining one day. He's the only guy out of those three who could still pull off his finishing move. Hogan can't do it. Hall can't do it, I don't think. Kevin Nash can. Bernice Zero Johnson. I heard some opinions a while back that Roman Reigns or Bray Wyatt should have been the one to end The Undertaker's undefeated streak of WrestleMania and continue on with a streak of their own. Could you see WWE doing another undefeated streak at Mania? Who would you want to see in that position if they did it? And do you think the fans would reject it if WWE attempted one? I don't think they should do it again. I do think that the fans would probably reject it. Look, you can't do another streak like The Undertaker's anyway. Nobody is ever going to be booked to go 20-0 or 21-1 that he ended up as. But, you know, 20-0 the guy went before he finally lost. There's nobody else that they would even have the patience to do that with. That's something people don't remember, is that back then, first of all, when The Undertaker started winning matches at WrestleMania, there was no attention paid to the fact that, hey, we're gonna make sure this guy goes undefeated for 20 years, okay? Believe me, nobody was thinking that at the beginning. And then somewhere along the way, at whatever number WrestleMania it was, somebody realized, hey, this guy's undefeated. And they started mentioning that. And then from there, it became a thing. Until it finally became the annual attraction at WrestleMania, overshadowing everything else, even the title match. It became this huge thing, this huge milestone. And it just happened over the course of so many years. There is no way that these people, Vince McMahon or the writers or anybody, would have the patience to invest in somebody and have them go undefeated for 20 years. So what's the point in doing another undefeated streak if somebody goes 10-0? Who gives a shit? It's not nearly as impressive as 20-0. So if you can't do 20-0, then you can't do it. It's just not going to work. And why are you going to duplicate the same angle anyway? I would hope that with Roman Reigns and Bray Wyatt, they could be a little more original than that. If there's an angle or a match that calls for them to lose at WrestleMania, then they should lose. With Undertaker, it just after a while, you wouldn't beat the guy. It just wasn't right. I wouldn't have beat the guy this year, but you know, Vince felt differently, so they beat him. And now they're trying to make the most of it with Brock Lesnar. At least it wasn't for nothing. But I wouldn't bother doing it again, because if you can't replicate or beat the original, then there's no point. You're wasting your time. And finally here, Drew, in Chicago. With Brock becoming champion, does the creative staff think the people only remember a few months back? I ask this because I understand why Brock had to be the one to beat Cena, but what I don't understand is how Triple H and Stephanie just forgot what happened 2 years ago when Brock not only F5 Vince McMahon and broke his hip, he broke Shawn Michaels' arm, he broke Triple H's arm twice. Not to mention Stephanie slapped Paul Heyman for talking crap about her kids, which resulted in matches at SummerSlam and WrestleMania. Why would Steph and Hunter be all smiles when giving the new belt to Brock? Am I the only one who thought there should have been a little brawl, or at least one of them saying, "We haven't forgotten what you did"? Believe me, I wanted Brock to win, but that presentation for the belt just felt a little off. Well, Drew, it's best for business. It's best for business, Drew. Come on, wake up. Storyline doesn't make any sense. Best for business. Now it makes sense. But how come this guy did this and this guy did that? Oop, doesn't matter. Best for business. That's their out now. They don't ever have to explain a storyline in this company ever again. All they have to do is just say, well, best for business. Of course, they think we're all stupid. And maybe we are. Hey, maybe there's something to that. Because they know that no matter what, we're going to keep watching anyway. So maybe they're right. And that's the mailbag. We have a sound-off throwback to get to this week before we wrap it up here. And this week's throwback goes back to 1 year ago. Sound-off episode 290. Aired on September 1st, 2013. Many of you remember the pipe bomb that AJ Lee dropped on the Divas division, and specifically all the women from Total Divas. How great was that, by the way? Easily the best women's promo I may have ever seen on that show ever in the history of the company. She was phenomenally brutal on that promo. And at one point, I remember she even, without actually saying it, she alluded to them performing certain sexual favors to get to where they were, which I don't want to cast aspersions here if that's true or not, but she said it. It was just a great promo. And one of the only negatives from that promo was the Bella Twins. And I just felt it was very appropriate for me to play this clip this week of all weeks, going back to 1 year ago, sound off episode 290.
It's time to go back in time.
I actually wanted to play the audio of what she said here, but I couldn't because the Bella Twins would not shut up over this entire thing. They were talking smack the whole time. They would not shut up throughout this entire segment. I blame the production crew also for not cutting their mics during this. You know, if they would have cut their mics, that would have solved the problem. You could show the Bellas getting angry and everything, but we wouldn't be able to hear them. But they kept their mics on. I wanted to put tape over their mouths. And here we are a year later. Some things never change. If you have questions for the mailbag, please email them to me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. I do read everything you send me, although I am very behind and doing my best to catch up on feedback. So email me there. You can follow me on Twitter, @solemonster is where I live tweet during Raw, all the pay-per-view shows. So follow me on there. We're on Facebook, The Solemonster with the extra E. That's my Facebook profile name. We have a closed discussion group on Facebook as well. You can apply for possible membership there. And we have a YouTube channel. Solemonster Sounds Off is the full title of the podcast. You can type that into YouTube. You'll find some of our videos, and from there you can subscribe. We are well on our way to 9,000 subscribers. So if you subscribe right now, you'll help us get there that much quicker. You can subscribe to the show in iTunes. You can also stream us on Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio. We have a free app in the Google Play Store for those of you with Android devices, an unofficial fan-made app for Windows users if you have Windows 8. So lots of different ways to keep in touch with the podcast. Big thank you, as always, to TV Tracks, who shows his love for the Sound Off, posting clips on his channel for his many followers each and every week. I very much appreciate him and his support. Please consider making a PayPal donation on thesolemonster.com or signing up for an Audible trial using our URL, audibletrial.com/solemonster. And that's going to wrap up episode 343. We will be back next weekend for a brand new episode of The Solemonster Sounds Off. 344 is coming up next Sunday. So until then, be well, stay safe, enjoy our new outro here. And we will see you right back here for a new episode next week. Take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solemonster Sounds Off.
Jonathan writes in, Sheamus and Dean Ambrose don't defend their U.S. title for weeks and how the titles mean shit. Let me school you, son. There's a big difference now, today, between the world title and the secondary titles. WWE has done a horrendous job. So they lose and they lose and they lose, and soon enough, people look at them as losers who happen to carry around a belt. That's not how you make your title seem important. Your champion should look strong. So now that I shot down your argument there, if Brock comes back and defends the title at Survivor Series, and then again at the Rumble, and again at Mania, the world will not end. Business will not die. But I guarantee you, those Brock Lesnar title defenses are going to be must-see TV when they happen. So, eat your sour grapes and just relax.
Solemonster Sounds Off.
Since 2007, on thesolemonster.com.
Stitcher Radio, and iTunes.
Solo Monsters Sound Off.